From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Good riddance. The world is better off without you, Mr. Saddam Hussein. It's fine. I find it very interesting that when the heat got on, you dug yourself a hole and you crawled in it. And our brave troops, combined with good intelligence, found you. And you'll be brought to justice, something you did not afford the people you brutalized in your own country. And
Saddam Hussein and human rights groups want him tried by an international court. The U.S.-appointed governing council wants him tried in Iraq. The United Nations opposes sentencing him to death. What will be the fate of Saddam Hussein? We'll hear excerpts of President Bush's news conference and go to Jordan to hear reaction to the Iraqi leader's capture in the Arab world. We'll also speak with former British Labour Minister Tony Benn in London. We'll go to The Hague, where Democratic presidential candidate Wesley Clark is testifying at the war crimes trial of Slobodan Milosevic. And remember how the U.S. was tapping phones and reading the email of U.N. Security Council members in the build-up to war? Well, the former British intelligence employee who leaked that story is facing up to 2 years in prison for her act. We'll look at the case of Catherine Gunn. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Saddam Hussein's family wants the former Iraqi leader to be tried by an international criminal court instead of a special tribunal set up by the U.S.-installed Iraq Governing Council. His daughter, Raghad Saddam Hussein, said her father appeared sedated in footage released after his capture and, quote, he would be a lion even when caged. Iraq's U.S.-appointed Governing Council members are confident Saddam will be tried before the Special War Crimes Tribunal and could face the death penalty. Council members told the Associated Press that the trial will be televised and could begin as soon as next few weeks or by summer. United Nations Security Council Secretary General Kofi Annan said yesterday the UN would not support bringing Saddam before a tribunal that might sentence him to death. In Britain, Foreign Secretary Jack Straw stated, while Britain opposes the death penalty, it will respect an Iraqi court's decision about the fate of Saddam Hussein. The Observer of London is reporting that the United Nations is threatening to pull out of Afghanistan if the United States and foreign troops cannot provide more security for aid workers. According to the Observer, 15 aid workers have now been killed in Afghanistan. Presidential envoy James Baker is in Paris today to meet with President Jacques Chirac in an attempt to persuade France to forgive billions of dollars in debt to Iraq. Ahead of the meeting, France announced it would forgive about $3 billion in debt. The former Secretary of State will continue on his five-day trip with stops in Germany and Russia. This marks Baker's first official trip since he joined the Bush administration 2 weeks ago. Baker remains a senior partner in the law firm of Baker Botts, which is deeply involved in the fight for oil and gas in the Caspian Sea. Among the clients of Baker Botts is the Saudi government in the suit filed by family members who lost relatives in 9/11. Baker Botts is representing the Saudi government against the 9/11 families. Baker is also a senior counsel to the powerful investment firm, the Carlyle Group. The Supreme Court agreed Monday to decide whether the Bush administration must publicly release the names of the members who comprised Vice President Dick Cheney's National Energy Policy Task Force. Cheney has refused to disclose what members of the oil, gas, coal, and nuclear industries helped to rewrite the nation's energy policy. Judicial Watch and the Sierra Club have sued for the list of advisors. The family of the late South Carolina Republican Senator Strom Thurmond acknowledged on Monday that Thurmond, who died in June at the age of 100, secretly had a child with his 16-year-old black maid almost 80 years ago. The family admitted this after a 78-year-old schoolteacher in Los Angeles came forward to say that Thurmond, who was a longtime supporter of segregation, was her father. The woman, Mae Washington Williams, said the senator remained close to her and provided her financial support, but they agreed never to disclose their relationship. The Reverend Jesse Jackson compared Thurman to Thomas Jefferson, who said to have children with one of his slaves named Sally Hemings. Jackson said, quote, "By the day they are bullies, by night they manipulate race to their advantage." During the 1950s, Thurman ran for president on a pro-segregationist ticket. Halliburton is coming under criticism from the Office of the New York City Comptroller for doing business in Iran. This according to a report in Cranes, New York. Acting on behalf of the police and fire department pension funds, City Comptroller William Thompson said Halliburton has reneged on an agreement to release a full report detailing the company's oil-related businesses in Iran. Iran is on the State Department's list of states that sponsor terrorism. Halliburton originally agreed to file the report after the pension fund threatened to pull its money out of Halliburton. The city made similar requests to General Electric and ConocoPhillips. In other Halliburton news, Reuters is reporting that the Pentagon allocated $222 million in new Iraq contracts last week to the company at the same time that a Pentagon audit had found Halliburton may have overbilled the U.S. government by more than $60 million. To date, Halliburton has received $2.25 billion in no bid contracts in Iraq. In Illinois, former death row prisoner Aaron Patterson has announced he's running for office in the Illinois State House. Patterson served 17 years on death row before being pardoned in January. He received over a $160,000 settlement from the state for his faulty murder conviction. On Monday, Secretary of State Colin Powell had surgery for prostate cancer and is expected to be recovering for the next month, during which time Deputy Secretary Richard Armitage will be in charge of the State Department. A federal commission examining Washington's so-called war on terror yesterday called on the Bush administration to form an independent board to ensure that new anti-terror efforts do not infringe on the civil liberties of Americans. Former Virginia governor and Republican Party chair James Gilmore heads the commission. Gilmore said, quote, "We are expressing concern and a simple warning that this must be constantly thought about. We should not fall into the pattern of suggesting that freedoms of the American people should be traded off for their security." In Italy, the country's president has vetoed a new media bill that would have further consolidated the nation's media into the hands of Silvio Berlusconi, Italy's prime minister and leading media mogul. While the bill goes back to Parliament for further debate, Berlusconi will be forced to sell off one of his three free network channels. Cable giant Comcast has hired former Pentagon PR specialist Victoria Clark to be a top lobbyist in Washington. Since leaving the Pentagon after the invasion, Clark has worked as an on-air analyst for CNN. According to the Washington Post, Clark's new job at Comcast will allow her to keep working for CNN and what the paper described as volunteering for the Pentagon. Democratic Senator John Breaux of Louisiana has announced he will not seek re-election next year, becoming the fifth Southern Democrat senator who will be retiring next year. There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the end. For only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and get here today. Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can. What's going on? Marvin Gaye here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Saddam Hussein's family wants the former Iraqi leader to be tried by an international court instead of a special tribunal set up by the U.S.-installed Iraqi Governing Council. His daughter, Ragad Saddam Hussein, said her father appeared sedated in the footage released after his capture and, quote, he would be a lion even when caged. Iraq's governing council members are confident Saddam will be tried before the Special War Crimes Tribunal and could face the death penalty. Council members told the Associated Press the trial will be televised and could begin as soon as the next few weeks or by summer. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said yesterday the UN would not support bringing Saddam Hussein before a tribunal that might sentence him to death. In Britain, Foreign Secretary Jack Straw stated, while Britain opposes the death penalty, it'll respect the Iraqi court's decision about the fate of Saddam Hussein. Meanwhile, a senior State Department official told Newsday that the Bush administration, quote, reserves the right to try Saddam for crimes against the United States. The official did not rule out the possibility of multiple prosecutions, adding that Kuwait and Iran also have an interest prosecuting Saddam Hussein. At a hastily arranged White House news conference, President George Bush yesterday refused to commit the United States to handing Hussein over to the Iraqis. Bush said Saddam Hussein will be put on trial in a manner to be determined in conjunction with Iraqis whom the former dictator brutalized across 30 years of rule. These are excerpts of his news conference.
Thank you, Mr. President. What's the United States going to do with Saddam Hussein after questioning him? Will he be turned over to Iraqis for trial? And based on what you know now about mass executions and hundreds of thousands of graves, do you think that execution should be an option?
He will be detained. We will work with the Iraqis to develop a way to try him. That will stand international scrutiny, I guess is the best way to put it. I shared my sentiments today with Prime Minister Martin of Canada. He asked me about Saddam Hussein and his trial. I said, look, the Iraqis need to be very much involved. He was the person that, they were the people that were brutalized by this man. He murdered them, he gassed them, he tortured them, he had rape rooms. And they need to be very much involved in the process, and we'll work with the Iraqis to develop a process. And of course we want it to be fair. And of course we want the world to say, well, this, you know, we got a fair trial, because whatever justice is meted out needs to stand international scrutiny. I've got my own personal views of how he ought to be treated, but I'm not an Iraqi citizen. It's going to be up to the Iraqis to make those decisions. Yeah, I said I have my own personal views. And this is a brutal dictator. He's a person who killed a lot of people. And but my views, my personal views aren't important in this matter. What matters is the views of the Iraqi citizens. We need to work, of course, with them to develop a system that is fair and where he will be put on trial and will be brought to justice. The justice he didn't, by the way, afford any of his own fellow citizens.
And that was President Bush yesterday at a news conference in response to the capture of Saddam Hussein. Coming up on the program, we're going to The Hague, where Democratic presidential candidate Wesley Clark is testifying at the war crimes trial of Slobodan Milosevic. But right now, we go to London to speak with the former Labour parliamentarian Tony Benn, who was in the British Parliament for more than half a century and was among the last to meet Saddam Hussein in an interview that we broadcast on Democracy Now! Tony Benn, welcome to Democracy Now! It's good to have you with us. Your response to what has unfolded over the last few days?
Well, I've just come back last night from Cairo, where there was a huge conference on the crisis in the Middle East with about 1,000 people, and Ramsay Clark, the former Attorney General of the United States, and Dennis Halliday were there, and about 100 delegates from Britain. And, of course, there, Main focus is on Palestine and what's happening to them, but Saddam's arrest came at the end of the conference. A lot of questions were asked about it. I mean, I think nobody doubts the man was a brutal dictator with many crimes against him, particularly against the Iraqis, but it did raise in people's minds the extent to which the trial would be able to bring out a lot of other things, including the role played by the United States and Britain in arming Saddam. And whether this will be permitted or not, I do not know. I'd be surprised if Rumsfeld would want to be subpoenaed to appear in a trial in Baghdad as to the role he played in supplying elements for weapons, which he did.
What is your response to your countryman, Foreign Secretary Jack Straw, who said that Britain would not object to a trial that could lead to the death penalty, though it is not allowed in Britain, if that were the decision of Iraqi courts?
Well, the Iraqi court will be set up, of course, by an American administration. It's an occupying army. The governing council are their puppets, and the court would be under that. And for a British minister who is totally opposed in principle nationally and internationally to the death penalty to say that, I think is an indication that he felt that this is what the president would want and wouldn't want to seem to differ from him. But it's quite outrageous because we've taken a very principled position on the death penalty, and to suggest that there's an exception in this particular case would just make a mockery of the claim to have a principled position on public on executions.
We just got this report from Reuters Newswire. It's from Herzliya, Israel. It says Israeli commandos plan to assassinate Saddam Hussein at a funeral after the 91 Gulf War, but the operation was aborted after five soldiers were killed in training. That's according to security sources cited by Reuters. It says military censors lifted a decade-old ban on reporting the plan on Monday, allowing newspapers to publish details of the aborted mission just days after the ousted Iraqi leader was captured. The Israeli government never got as far as approving the plan meant to retaliate for Scud missile attacks in Israel during the Gulf War. Israeli commandos would have been dropped deep in Iraqi territory several miles from a cemetery where Saddam was expected at the funeral of an uncle who was believed by Israeli military intelligence to be near death. The soldiers would have fired a specially adapted smart missile with a small camera in its nose, allowing them to target Saddam amidst a crowd of officials, family members, and bodyguards attending the funeral. But the operation was abandoned after five soldiers were killed by a missile in a rehearsal of the mission at a training base in southern Israel on November 5th, 1992.
Well, that is well documented, and I mean, there's a lot to come out. But I think what it highlights is that assassination is accepted as a legitimate policy by Israel, by the United States, and indeed Britain tried to assassinate President Nasser at the time of the Suez War. I mean, in the old days, when charges of assassination were laid against governments, they always denied it, but now they don't. And indeed, the Israeli cabinet considered the assassination of Arafat. President Bush's view of assassination is a bit unclear, but having ordered Saddam, offered, what was it, $25 million alive or dead, it did imply that a dead body would have been acceptable and that would have involved an assassination. And I think this is some indication of the complete disappearance from any moral or legal basis for policy if you're strong enough to carry it through. That's the situation we're in, and it is, in that sense, just such an incredible denigration of what we're supposed to be about and believers in international law and even moral law, if you like, in the conduct of our affairs.
Tony Benn, we have to break for 60 seconds. We'll be back with the former Labour parliamentarian after this break. Stay with us. Drummers of the Nile here on Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're talking to Tony Benn, former Labour parliamentarian for more than half a century in Britain. He's speaking to us from London, just returned from Cairo. Before we go back to him, we thought we'd go to some tape from last February. This was, I believe, the last recorded interview of Saddam Hussein, and it was Tony Benn in Iraq interviewing Saddam Hussein. Let's take a listen.
Mr. President, may I ask you some questions? The first question is, does Iraq possess weapons of mass destruction?
Most Iraqi officials have been in power for over 34 years and have experience of dealing with the outside world. Every fair-minded person knows that when Iraqi officials say something, they are trustworthy. A few minutes ago, when you asked me if I wanted to look at the questions beforehand, I told you I didn't feel the need, so that we don't waste time. And I gave you the freedom to ask me any question directly, so that my reply would be direct. This is an opportunity to reach the British people and the forces of peace in the world. There is only one truth, and therefore, I tell you, as I have said on many occasions before, that Iraq has no weapons of mass destruction whatsoever. We challenge anyone who claims that we have to bring forward any evidence and present it to public opinion.
I have another question which has been raised.
And that's just an excerpt of the extended interview that Tony Benn did with Saddam Hussein that ran in many parts of the world, hardly here in the United States, except on Pacifica Radio. But Tony Benn, do you remember that moment? Interesting to hear the question about weapons of mass deception, Saddam Hussein denying it. Reports are that when he was asked again after he was captured, he said that this is what he had said all along.
Well, I do believe what he said. I asked him a number of questions. That was the first, and the second was links with Al-Qaeda, which he denied, and that is certainly true, because anyone in America who thinks he had anything to do with September the 11th is totally misinformed. But the question of the weapons of mass destruction, I also discussed with General Saeedi, who was a very distinguished Iraqi general who worked with Blitz. And he told me that they had had them in the 90s, early 90s, and had ended them. And Mr. Blair made the big point of the justification for the war, that these weapons that could be used within 45 minutes, and what is it, over 300 days or 200 days later, none of them have been found. And if it is true that Saddam, when captured, repeated that, it does undermine the case that was used for attacking Iraq. And if Saddam is gone and there are no weapons, why are the United States and Britain still there? I mean, very big questions are raised by the capture of Saddam and any interrogation of him in confirming what he told me personally in Baghdad in February.
Tony Benn, you're in the parliament for more than 50 years in Britain. Can you reflect on the place we are in history right now?
Well, strangely, when I was in Cairo on Saturday, I gave the keynote address at this conference, and I was introduced by a man who said that I spoke with Tony Benn in Trafalgar Square in London in 1956 at the time of the Suez War. And I remembered him, of course, And you see, the early part of my life was to see the end of European empires, the French Empire in Algeria and Vietnam, the Portuguese Empire in Goa, the British Empire in India and Africa. And now I find imperialism is returning and is being treated as a serious and necessary policy, not just by President Bush, who is the new emperor, you might think, argued for it, but by the British as well. And so you then say, well, now, what are the elements that build up empire? Well, the military strength, and the United States has got, I think, 742 bases in 142 countries in the world, and over a bigger defense budget than the rest of the world put together. But also, it is the acceptance by people who are occupied or dominated, and I think that acceptance has now, well, it is now under threat. I think a lot of people in the Middle East and all over the world just don't accept it. And of course, if imperialism meets resistance, then it creates a resistance in the home country, just as in the United States now. There are people who, the families of the soldiers, who want them home. They see the impact of it on the American economy. They see the huge profits made by Halliburton and the oil companies, the arms manufacturers, and therefore I can see, looking at it now with a long historical perspective, I can see the ingredients of the decline of American imperialism, even though the United States is more powerful than any country in the whole history of the world has ever been. But the elements are there, and if, of course, next year when the presidential election comes, there was a change of administration in the White House, it would mark a very, very significant historical development that would help the world to find peace in the longer run.
Tony Benn, I was wondering if you could stay on the line with us.
Of course.
Because we want to take a look at someone who few Americans well recognize her name, Catherine Gunn. I'm looking at a piece by Norman Solomon, who's also joined us on the line, who's co-author of the book Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, and is head of the Institute for Public Accuracy. But Norman reminds us, few Americans have heard of Catherine Gunn, the former British intelligence employee facing charges that she violated the Official Secrets Act. So far, the American press has ignored her, but the case raises profound questions about democracy and the public's right to know on both sides of the Atlantic. Norman Solomon, welcome to Democracy Now!, joining longtime, well, former Labor parliamentarian Tony Benn, as you lay out for us Catherine Gunn's case.
Yes, my article, unfortunately, when it appeared this Sunday in the Baltimore Sun, was the first substantial mention of this heroic woman in the entire U.S. press. And listeners to Democracy Now! Will recall, because this is one of the few programs to explore it, in March of this year, the Observer newspaper in London exposed a very secret memo that had just been leaked by someone, a memo from a top U.S. National Security Agency official, and it was an explosive memo in content. People will remember at that time the U.S. and Britain were pushing very hard to get through the U.N. Security Council a resolution for a war. They never got that resolution, but what the U.S. did do with apparent collusion from the Blair government was to wiretap and surveil a half a dozen key delegations at the U.N. to try to turn the screws on them, wiretapping their home office phones as well as emails. And we're talking about the governments, the delegations of Mexico, Chile, Angola, Cameroon, Guinea, and also Pakistan. And what was the purpose? They were trying to get this war resolution through the UN. And what it turns out Catherine Gunn did as an official at a secret handling British agency, what she did was she provided to this news outlet, The Observer, a memo that outlined from the U.S. National Security Agency this wiretap program in New York, in diplomatic circles, delegates from several continents.
And now, can you talk about what has happened?
Well, now the Blair government, no doubt with support from the Bush administration, is saying to Catherine Gunn, it is payback time. You were a major factor through your actions in making it possible for people to prevent a war resolution going through the UN Security Council. And so what happened was in March, she was quickly arrested. In June, she formally lost her job at the government communications headquarters in Britain. And last month, 4 weeks ago, her name became public knowledge in the British press because at that point, she was charged with violation of the Official Secrets Act. She's facing 2 years in prison. This is a 29-year-old woman who could have simply stood by and watched her country and the United States go to war. But it was a matter of conscience. It was a matter of democracy. It was a matter of trying to work with others to stop this war. And what I think we need to understand now as Americans, as people, is that we had every right to know our government was involved in these dirty tricks at the UN. We are in the debt of this woman who now is at great risk of going to prison. And it is absolutely essential that we take action to support her.
Tony Benn.
Well, I absolutely agree with that analysis. I mean, the things that are done by governments undercover throw a completely new light, or different light, I should say, on what's going on above. And when somebody, on the basis of moral principle, puts their conscience before official secrets, they do society they perform an essential function. And I think it does raise the question as to whether, if that woman is imprisoned, it doesn't throw doubt on the whole idea of the law being concerned with justice. I mean, it's rather like the situation at the moment. If you ask anyone in the world about American justice, they don't think of the Supreme Court in all its majesty. They think of Guantanamo Bay. And, we hold these truths to be self-evident and so on, which is the American Constitution. People say, oh, well, that's been abandoned a long time ago. And we've had cases in Britain, and I know you've had in the United States, of principled people who brought out the truth, and they should be accepted as having acted in accordance with their conscience. And conscience must be above the law, otherwise you do whatever you're told by anyone who happens to be in power.
Yes, and I think it's important to recognize for Americans to realize Katherine Gunn is a equivalent, really, of Daniel Ellsberg,
exactly,
who released the Pentagon Papers. And
yep.
I talked to Mr. Ellsberg, who told me that in many respects, her action was even more timely and more critical because she released this crucial information before the war began, and the potential was there to actually prevent those bombs and missiles from falling. And I want to ask Democracy Now! Listeners to write down this information. You can take action to support Katherine Gunn and what she represents. You can inform yourself by reading the article in the Baltimore Sun that I wrote. It's posted on the website accuracy.org. Just go to accuracy.org, click on articles. You can read it and then take action. Call media outlets around the country. Demand that they at last cover this story. Ask that members of Congress take appropriate action. And also, it's crucial, please send a letter of support for Katherine Gunn. It's easy to do. Go to your email and send it to me. I will forward it on. Just send it to care of norman@accuracy.org. That's just norman@accuracy.org.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. We've been speaking with Norman Solomon, who has done one of the rare pieces in this country on Katherine Gunn, the former British intelligence employee facing charges that she violated the Official Secrets Act. And finally, Tony Benn, in Britain, among those in the anti-war movement, which is a very significant movement in Britain, has Katherine Gunn become a major focus, or is there as little to understand? Do people know little about her there like they do here?
Not as much as should be known, for the reasons you've heard, because you see, secrecy is two levels. There's government secrecy that is supposed to shut you up. But then even if it comes out, there's media censorship, self-censorship, which they doesn't publicize it. And I don't know how many people generally are aware of the work she did or the threat that faces her. We've had equivalents of Daniel Ellsberg here, and some of them have been imprisoned and punished, and that is a continual threat. that hangs over people. But I do think the media share responsibility, because if they don't publish what is known, illegally become known, if you know what I mean, if they don't publish what is released or leaked, then they keep everybody in the dark. And I think this appeal to newspapers to give better coverage is of great importance.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us as we turn now to Hassan Abu Nima. That was Tony Benn, former longtime Labour parliamentarian, speaking to us from Britain, just back from Egypt, and Norman Solomon of the Institute for Public Accuracy. Hassan Abu Nima has also just returned from Egypt to his home in Amman. He is the former Jordanian ambassador to the United States. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello?
It's good to have you with us.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with you.
Can you share with us your response to the events over the weekend and the discussion now about what should happen to Saddam Hussein, who should be trying him?
Okay, may I make just a slight correction? I was ambassador to the United Nations, not to the United States.
Yes.
Is that okay?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, now about Saddam, you know, the feelings that people are stunned at the way Saddam was captured less than 2 days ago. It's, of course, for me, it's a very significant development in the history of the region, because Saddam was, in a way, obstructing the abnormal development of the region for almost three decades. He initiated a lot of wars. He made things difficult not only for the people in his country, but for the most of the people and the countries in the region. And I think it was due to his behavior that we had two major wars in which the United States was involved. I'm not endorsing the war in any sense, but I think that with such behavior, sometimes the consequences get out of hand and get out of control, and he should bear a lot of responsibility for what happened, regardless of how wrong or right the first war was actually more justified, because it was necessary to liberate Kuwait. The second war is more controversial, but regardless, the capture of Saddam Hussein is the end of an era, a very dark era in the history of this region. It is important. We all hope here that it will put an end to a situation which was utterly abnormal, and we hope we would be heading towards better days for Iraq and for the region. And just to make myself very clear, that doesn't mean at all that this will solve the difficulties and the problems of the occupation, of the war, but it's necessary for its own sake, I should say.
What about the reaction in general, both in Egypt, from where you've just come, and where you are right now in Amman, Jordan?
Well, people were reacting as probably they did everywhere else. How was he caught? Why didn't he shoot himself? Was he gassed? Would he cooperate? You know, these are the simple questions. Some simplistic interpretations talk about the possibility of his being held in American custody for longer than people thought, and it was just the news were just released the time they were. I mean, you know, all these kind of interpretations. There are a lot of people who believe in conspiracy theories, and they used to talk about Saddam and bin Laden as being allowed to escape by the Americans because they were cooperating with them earlier. I mean, all this nonsense. But on the question of what will happen, to tell you the truth, people are not sure. Now, everyone is talking about what kind of a trial he will get. Will it be in Iraq? Would it be a fair trial, or the justice of the victors? Would it be in The Hague? You know, these are the kinds of questions. But honestly, I mean, people know that Saddam Hussein is not the kind of person who would find many people to be sorry for what happened to him. He brought this upon himself, upon his country, upon his family, upon his people, upon the region. He's been really a dark stain on the history of this region for the last two or three decades.
And what about when you were Jordan's ambassador to the United Nations? What was the period of time that you served?
I was there from 1995 till 2000.
Your reaction at that time, you were then dealing with the Iraqi ambassador to the UN, you were dealing with Iraq, you were dealing with the sanctions against Iraq. Can you talk about Saddam Hussein at that time from a diplomatic perspective and where he had come from, where he had gotten his support from?
I dealt with the Iraqi ambassador at the United Nations at the time, a very reasonable man who was earlier ambassador in Washington. Unfortunately, he's not alive anymore. He died due to terminal illness a year ago. We were dealing with sanctions, yes. We didn't think at that time that sanctions were the best way to deal with the complex, delicate, difficult situation in Iraq. There was a lot of feeling amongst diplomats there that sanctions were hurting the wrong people. They were hurting the innocent people of Iraq, and they were, in fact, benefiting the regime. From 1995, late 95, when the Oil for Food program was initiated and started to be implemented, you know, it helped the regime to blame the United Nations and the United States for the hardships to which the Iraqi people were subjected. And that was a way for the regime to say it's not us. We are all being targeted by our, by the United States, by Britain, by the United Nations. And that's why we are having these difficult times. So I think in hindsight now, one could say, I'm not claiming that this is the ultimate wisdom, that the sanctions helped the regime and helped Saddam. So, they hurt a lot the Iraqi people. And that's why the policy of maintaining the sanctions indefinitely with the target as the regime, not the target as disarming Iraq, because Iraq was actually disarmed and the results of the war have proven that. So this was the feeling. It helped Saddam. And also, he was helped by the cruelty of the sanctions, which made him and his people, not only from the Iraqi perspective, from a general perspective, look like victims.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We have been speaking with Hassan Abu Nima, the former Jordanian ambassador to the United Nations, speaking to us from Amman, Jordan. When we come back from our break, we're going to The Hague to find out why the Democratic presidential candidate Wesley Clark is there. Stay with us. Drummers of the Nile here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. Democratic presidential candidate Wesley Clark has ended his first day of testimony in the war crimes trial of Slobodan Milosevic. Clark is the former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO and the man who led the 78-day bombing of Yugoslavia in 1999. Milosevic is officially charged with genocide and crimes against humanity in a number of indictments spanning from the wars in Croatia and Bosnia to the fighting in Kosovo. In an unprecedented agreement between the court and the United States, Washington will be allowed to review Wesley Clark's testimony before it is made public. The U.S. will have 2 days to apply for parts of the testimony to be removed from the public record if it considers them harmful to U.S. national interests. An edited recording is due to be made public on Friday. Clark said before testifying he expected to give information on more than 100 hours of meetings over 4 years with Milosevic during the 90s. The two-day session in camera that began yesterday may turn out to foreshadow arrangements made for the trial of Saddam Hussein, whose friendly relations with the U.S. and British governments in the 1980s are likely to prove embarrassing if testimony is in open court. Speaking outside the court afterwards, Wesley Clark said, "For the people of the region, it's a very important experience. It's the rule of law. It's closure with a man who caused the deaths or is alleged to have caused the deaths of hundreds of thousands throughout Europe." We go now to The Hague to Liljana Smiljevic. She is a columnist for the leading Serbian news weekly called NIN. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Liljana.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Well, you have been covering the trial of Slobodan Milosevic from the beginning. Can you talk about the climate there right now? What Wesley Clark, what you understand he has said, and also what Milosevic has said as well?
Well, first of all, I want to say that Wesley Clark is not like any other witness this trial has seen. Usually the judge admonishes the witness, and if the witness needs to return the next day, the judge always says, make sure that you do not speak about your testimony to anyone or about this trial. Well, Mr. Clark has been speaking about both his testimony and the trial. He's made comments outside of the courtroom both days. As soon as he would leave the witness stand, he would come out of the building and address reporters. Last night, he made a speech about the new Atlantic Charter here at an Institute of International Relations in The Hague, but he also spoke about the trial again. So in this sense, Mr. Clark has not acted like other witnesses, and obviously the conditions set upon his testimony are different than those for any other witness, which also makes it clear that some countries' national security is more important than other countries' national security here in The Hague. What seems to have transpired here from what Mr. Clark told us after his testimony is that the judge had severely restricted Mr. Milosevic's ability to cross-examine Mr. Clark on anything pertaining to the NATO bombing of Serbia and the Kosovo War in 1999. The judge limited Milosevic to Mr. Clark's testimony about the events in Srebrenica and the genocide that took place there in 1995.
For listeners and viewers who are not familiar with Srebrenica or need to be reminded, can you describe what happened in Srebrenica?
Yes, in Srebrenica, over 7,000 Muslim men were killed by Bosnian Serb forces after the Bosnian Serb forces overran a Muslim enclave in eastern Bosnia. And Mr. General Mladic, Ratko Mladic, the Bosnian Serb commander, is responsible for this crime, and he has been indicted by the Hague Tribunal. The importance of linking General Mladic to Mr. Milosevic, who at the time was president of Yugoslavia, and had no official links with the Bosnian Serb army commander, the importance of Clark's testimony is in trying to link Milosevic directly to through Mladic, which would establish command responsibility on the side of Milosevic. Mr. Clark is supposed to have testified. He more or less made it clear that this is what he testified, that in a conversation with Mr. Milosevic in 1995, Mr. Milosevic told him that he had foreknowledge of Mladic's actions to take over Srebrenica and that he was unable to stop Mr. Mladic from overrunning the enclave. Therefore, this would be important if the judges took Mr. Clark's word. This would be an important testimony in showing that Milosevic had foreknowledge and failed to stop someone that, in Mr. Clark's testimony, was his subordinate. So, indeed, this was a significant testimony if the judges take it for granted, and it is that's why it's understandable that Carlo Del Ponte, who was not too pleased about the conditions that the U.S. government has imposed for this testimony, that she went along with this, although this closed session and airing the footage of the trial 48 hours later makes her court look a little bit like a victor's court and takes away from perhaps the appearance of the fairness of the trial and the equality of arms between in front of the judges. But this is why she has agreed, because she still has not yet properly, I believe even in the prosecution's eyes, it has not yet been firmly established and that Mr. Milosevic was responsible, has been linked personally to the genocide of Srebrenica, and Ms. Del Ponte, the prosecutor in The Hague, only has perhaps another month to prove that most important charge in her indictment, the genocide charge against Milosevic.
We're talking to Liljana Smiljevic, who is a columnist for the leading Serbian news weekly. She's in The Hague speaking to us on her cell phone, so sorry for the bad sound, but we thought it was critical to go directly to the place right now where the trial of Slobodan Milosevic is going on and Democratic presidential candidate Wesley Clark has just testified. Again, Wesley Clark, not just a presidential candidate, but the former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, the man who led the 78-day bombing of Yugoslavia in 1999. Now, Wesley Clark talked about the trial of Slobodan Milosevic as a kind of model for a trial for Saddam Hussein. Liljana Smiljevic, can you talk about the reaction in The Hague of the capture of Saddam Hussein? And because you're at The Hague, what people are saying about what should happen to him now?
Well, Serbian reporters have remarked that Mr. Milosevic had been practically a political corpse after October 5th of the year 2000 when he was deposed and when he lost an election. And he was an irrelevant man to the politics of the country until he was extradited to The Hague and until his trial, which is broadcast back to Belgrade Live, started here in The Hague in 2001. And now Mr. Milosevic is running in an election in Serbia. On December 28th, there's going to be a parliamentary election. Mr. Milosevic is heading his party list, the Socialist Party of Serbia, and he is virtually assured of being elected to the Serbian parliament. Now, Mr. Clark is also in the middle of an election campaign, but Mr. Clark also talked about Saddam, and he said that there are important lessons that he is going to offer in the coming days about this trial as an important precedent and as possibly a model to what will happen to Saddam. Well, if Mr. Milosevic's trial and his political fortunes, which have been revived since the beginning of the trial, if that is any indication, then perhaps Mr. Saddam's trial could also be a not quite welcome surprise to people who expect to seal the image of Saddam as a criminal, as a dictator, and as someone who harmed his people and his nation more than anyone else.
Milosevic, what is the penalty he faces?
Milosevic's penalty, the top penalty, is a life sentence if he is convicted of all the charges. There is no capital punishment in the Hague Tribunal.
What does it mean to say that, yeah, he is running for office? In terms of practically what can Milosevic do?
Why this is important to him, and now this goes into the specifics of Serbian politics, but for example, if his party gets into parliament with, let's say, a 10% majority, meaning that they would have, if the socialists win 10% of the seats in Serbia's parliament, Mr. Milosevic gets some leverage over Serbian politics. He can cut deals with the ruling authorities. There are things he still wants in Serbia. He wants his wife to be able to visit him. His wife has been wanted in Serbia for a lesser crime of influencing state officials while Milosevic was president. And Mr. Milosevic will use his seats, not only his own, but his party's seats in parliament to negotiate with the ruling party, to obtain possibly dropping of charges against his wife. He will be able to sell votes in parliament for his own benefit. He's not going to be a major player, but if he wins up to 25 deputies in the Serbian parliament, he can influence things in Serbia to some extent.
Well, Liliana Smilovic, I want to thank you very much for being with us, speaking to us from The Hague, where Wesley Clark has just finished his first day of testimony in the trial of Slobodan Milosevic. And that does it for the show, though. Another piece of news from The Hague. Mexico accused the United States at an International Court of Justice hearing on Monday of violating international law over its treatment of more than 50 Mexican nationals on death row in the United States, saying that the U.S. must comply with international law when dealing with Mexican nationals on death row in the United States. That does it for the show. Our website is democracynow.org. You can get a copy of the show by calling 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadusan and Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Purvesh Sharma, Mike DeFilippo and Rich Kim are our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.